The Right to Question is supported in part by the Paul Allen Family Foundation, by Humanities Montana, and by listeners like you.
What were you searching for when you left Los Angeles and moved to Utah?
I hate to put too grand a name to it, but I think in retrospect I was looking for meaning that I wasn't finding, not so much at the fault of Los Angeles, but by the way I was living in Los Angeles, and I needed to jumpstart myself and move away and see where else I might find a better answer and figure out how to address my question more closely. It immediately goes into kind of sounding pretty grand, but I was looking for, you know, the meaning of, if not everyone's life, my life.
Welcome to The Right Question, a program that features writers from the Western U.S. I'm Cherie Newman. My guest this time is Liz Stevens, author of The Days Are Gods, a memoir published by the University of Nebraska Press as part of their American Lives series. Where did the title of your book come from, The Days Are Gods?
That's from an Emerson quote, no one suspects the days to be gods, and the context in which he uses it is what you'd expect, that he is moving through life and looking for meaning, and finds that the meaning is his daily life, and it is what he addresses constantly in a kind of quotidian way. So those accrue into the entire meaning of your life. And I was actually having a kind of, you know, highfalutin philosophical conversation with a friend at a bar, which took the edge off of it. But it's not something I'm prone to doing. But I found myself paraphrasing, you know, that passage in particular, and really kind of having a rant about it. And I discovered that it really stuck with me, and I traditionally have not been great with titles, and I realized right when I heard it, it chimed something in me, and I thought, that's it. That's what the book is about. The book itself walks a line between a sort of grand scheme of things and a daily reality of the way that we can approach that, and I thought that the title suited that tone.
It did. Well, let's begin where the book begins. You're in your early 20s. You moved from Chicago to Los Angeles looking for excitement. And 10 years later, while working as a well-paid crew member for television commercials, you start to think that, quote, 10 years of being 24 was enough. And so you started on this quest. A lot of things happened very quickly. You applied to graduate school, were accepted, married your longtime boyfriend, bought a house in the Cache Valley in Utah, moved in, and started looking for, as you wrote, a set of stories to inhabit. Did that intention come in retrospect, or did you really go to Utah looking for a set of stories to inhabit?
That's a great question. I really went with that intention. I might not have articulated it in that way, but I was struck before I left, even, you know, you're really steeped in Los Angeles, for better or worse, and depending on your field, in a constant awareness of reality and kind of this meta reality, this greater than performative kind of nature of things that I think humans can't really avoid. But I'd been given a framework by the nature of the way I lived and where I lived to look at life in that way. And of course, what I was trying to do at that age, then finally with those realizations, is leapfrog that kind of ironic viewing of my own life as a story that I wanted to make up as I went along. On the other hand, to try and remedy that, I went immediately to another set of cultural stories. And I have some experience, family experience in the South and the Southwest, depending on where you live. You call Oklahoma one or the other. But, you know, and of course, the South has a huge tradition of a literary tradition of stories, and each region does. But for whatever reason, the West appealed to me particularly. You know, we want to think that we can overcomplicate things, but I think put to a point, we think of a region, and if we had to, if we made one of our students, for instance, do this, or as a writing exercise, you could pick the top 12 words that you might think describe that region. And the words that suited the West to me at that age were the ones that I wanted to internalize for myself. And so when I went to the West, it was with the very deliberate intention of becoming the type of person that could master what I saw as the authenticity of the experiences of the West. Of course, then I was confronted with the reality of the people that actually lived that and who knew that I was really putting it on as a kind of lesson, and that became a whole new experience.
Yeah, one thing that I found very enjoyable about reading your book was the authenticity with which you looked at that period of your life, because it was like you traded the romance of Hollywood for the romance of the mythic West in Utah, and you seemed to view everything around you in relationship to a book or a movie you'd seen.
I did. And I think that I would judge myself more harshly for that, except that I think that so many of us view our experiences in that way now. We see it through the lens of something that we've already seen, you know. And in fact, people in the West itself often do that. You can bet that my neighbor, who was the ex-cowboy, did he love Western movies? Yes, he did. So, you know, Jane Tompkins wrote a book about cowboys trying to live up to a national cowboy ideal. So people, I think they do look to stories and movies as a way of reflecting their own lives. I did, of course, see the irony of that, and I naturally come with a bit of kind of, it's not so much self-deprecation as it is a deprecation of the extreme proudness of humanity or anybody thinking they're kind of above pretending. And I think that weaving that into the text deliberately was a way of showing conscious awareness of that balance, what I was using culturally and what I was really living. Because, of course, it's not as glamorous as any movie or book could make the West. I mean, you're stepping in, you know, animal stuff, and they're, you know, dying and living and being messy and awkward around you. And it turned out that the truth of all of it was much more appealing than even the movies could have made it be.
Well, let's back up just a little bit to when you first arrived. You and your husband bought a house mm-hmm. there, and then you immediately started collecting animals.
We did. In retrospect, it amazes me that not once did we consider living in the university town proper where I was going to be going to graduate school up in Logan, Utah. And nor, when we looked at the house in Wellsville, did we look at the houses right in town. And I'm using air quotes that you can't see here, but it really is a tidy and charming little town. But even that, of course, it has the blocks after the initial blocks on the main street come with horse property and a barn and the whole set of stuff. And we didn't even consider anything on less than an acre, and we wanted just as much as we could get space-wise. So we really literally bought into the whole image of what we were trying to do. And so then when you have that space, you think, well, what, you know, we have outbuildings that are at least so useful that our neighbors are asking to use them, you know, milk shed, a hay shed, our barn. So these are things that people really, you know, direly needed. And so we couldn't let them kind of languish on the property while we figured out, you know, read our manuals on horsemanship and such. So we started filling things immediately. And with everybody around you telling you, it's easy to raise chickens, it's easy to raise goats, just get this stuff and we'll help you figure it out if anything goes wrong. Well, you jump in. So we definitely started collecting immediately, and it was worth it.
You jumped in. I mean, you had just several weeks before had seen your first cow and started yelling, cow, cow.
Yes, that's true. Yeah, we immediately wanted them just up as close as we could get them. We really did. It's something about the eye contact and dealing with them and everything. It was, if anything, that was going to be easier, I should say simpler to deal with than negotiating the humans. So we were willing to start with that.
Yes. And, yeah. Well, there's a passage I'd like you to read that captures how you felt not too long after you arrived in Utah, on pages 41 and 42.
Okay. The chapter, Wary. I know it's silly, the flat-out mark of a city dweller, but it seems kind of, well, cool after I'd begun to settle in when I hear pheasants just outside my kitchen window or watch them dodging the horses in the paddock outside my office. My 10-year-old neighbor waves his BB gun at them and looks at me out of a wary sideways eye, the way nearly everyone here looks at us when they think we aren't looking. I tell him I don't need any favors when he offers to clear the property of magpies. Even magpies? He whines and walks away, dragging his gun in what can't be an NRA-recommended fashion. Anyone with sense would know magpies were put on the earth for target practice. We attend rodeos with the fervor of converts, zealots who now know every rule of calf roping, three legs doesn't count, bronc riding, keep your heels up on her neck, mutton busting, crying's allowed in this event only, and that what the British call scones is not what you get at the state fair rodeo, where scones means Navajo fry bread. We go to a rodeo on the Wyoming state line, the arena set in a bowl of earth partway up a mountain. When we'd got lost, looking for it, no signs anywhere, and we didn't know yet that in every town there's a main street, one main cross street, and a riding arena on the edge of town under a couple of big lights you could see at night for miles. We'd rolled the car window down and driven quietly along until we heard an announcer's voice carrying out over the cool late afternoon air. Not a single person is there playing cowboy, wearing the outfit in hopes that someone will see them being Western. They just are. Hundreds of people standing in this bowl of light that the sunset hits, where at evening, dark spills out the bottom edge to cover the entire plain below. In time, people carry their toddlers like sacks of flour over their shoulders to the car for the long, sleepy drive home. I'm exquisitely aware that I'm not a visitor now. I, too, am only driving a few miles home, not the thousands of miles in my life it took to get there. Somewhere in this halcyon time, I remember that I'm only a local in my own mind. I fret with and try and parse my highly conscious sense of my surroundings, examining it for ironic detachment. But in truth, I'm already in over my head. I'm already cut loose from the pattern in my life of seeking myself solely in the face of others. So I'm in new territory in every sense. In other words, I thought it would matter more if the locals here liked me, wanted me here, or thought I could hack it. But instead, I expend more effort actually hacking it than thinking about it. I'm in love. It's the landscape that draws me and keeps me here, concurrently spare and breathtaking enough to empty my mind of chatter like hours of meditation I could never sit through. Movies and books were telling me how to read the land before I arrived, but I know I've prepped myself by careful selection of my sources. Never mind that thousands of people died or went insane throughout history trying to live the reality of this lyrical idea. The notion that the harshness of the land is pure romantic challenge. You always think you'll be the one to make the living look easy. Well, not too easy. That wouldn't be any fun.
You're listening to The Right Question. I'm Cherie Newman talking with Liz Stevens, author of a memoir titled The Days Are God's. If you tuned in late, you can listen to what you missed from our blog, which you'll find at mtpr.org/twq. We'll be right back after a short break to talk more about Liz and her husband's move to Utah and to hear another passage from the book. Your husband, Christopher, didn't make the adjustment to rural life quite as well as you did, it seemed. He went from earning $40 an hour to scrambling for low-wage employment in the area, and from optimal health to standing around smoking cigarettes. And, you know, it just, it seemed like he didn't have the same giddiness about some things that you did.
No, it's true. He was having an existential crisis veiled as a career change. You know, I took him away from not necessarily what was happening in our day-to-day life in Los Angeles, but his ideas of what he was on his way to doing in Los Angeles. And I really slotted into a specific spot, at least in terms of academia. My negotiation of my kind of social spot was a lot more complicated, simply because I wasn't willing to give up, also being a townie. But he was in a literal no man's land, really. He's a very, you know, kind of introspective person, a thoughtful person, and artful, and was typecast, really, by the look of him and the kind of work he was going to get into needing to be a totally different type of person to fit in there. And I think he discovered over that first year how difficult that was going to be.
And he didn't look like the local men. He had tattoos and...
He didn't look like the local man. In fact, one of our first experiences there was that we were at the Walmart and we were buying some necessities. And a woman, the checker, saw his arms, saw his tattoos, and she said, "My old man is in jail, and he has loads of tattoos, the way that you do, and he is thinking of coming back to the Valley, and he doesn't know what kind of work he'll get." And, you know, here my Shakespearean actor was standing there kind of gobsmacked, like, I get one or the other here. I'm, you know, farm guy, and I have no knowledge of that, or I'm presumed to be kind of this ex-con. So it was a whole new set of things. It didn't come with any, you know, trendiness or generational meaning or anything, the whole kind of tattooed look. So we knew immediately it was a whole new ball game.
Just in general, to people who grew up and have lived in the Western United States for their whole lives, the word Californian has a particular meaning. So tell a little bit about how that label affected both of you.
It absolutely did. I mean, we came with a big, big stamp on our forehead. And we found immediately that we could say the slightest thing that to us sounded conversational, and it sounded like name-dropping. You know, if you try and tell a story about your past, like, well, we were at our house, and then say we're leading up to a story of the 94 earthquake or something. Well, and then somebody ran out to get lunch, and I remembered that it was the greatest lunch. That was my first memory of the day, and somebody says, "Well, where's the restaurant?" And we say, "Oh, on Melrose near Vine," and you get this tone back that says kind of, yeah, you know, so it, you couldn't... It was easy to inadvertently talk about experiences in Los Angeles and have them misread as trying to sound like we ourselves were in a movie or were part of something, you know, grand, when in fact I constantly wanted to say, I left it, you know, I didn't think it was so grand, I was prepared to leave it. So it was a whole different set of things. It's not as if we moved also to Utah from Central California or even San Bernardino Valley. So we had moved from Los Angeles, and we had to be very careful not to talk about it too much, or it made us kind of look like we were trying too hard. So, of course, it wasn't true for every one of our friends that we spoke to, but there was a general sense that it was not a comfortable subject. On the other hand, if you strip away the fact that you can't tell most of your stories, kind of your cocktail party stuff, then it really makes you better listeners, and it makes you more receptive to what's immediately in front of you. And so talking about other people's experiences, talking about which it almost sounds too good to be true or something, but in this small town we were living in, really church, farm, and missions and these things, these were the primary topics. And so by us not kind of putting on our dog and pony show and telling our, you know, kind of party stories to and with each other and about each other, it meant that we were more receptive to everything that we were being told and hearing around us. So that was a nice benefit. And hopefully we've retained a little bit of that listening rather than talking.
It seemed like you became much more attuned just to details, not only because you were living in a place where there were spectacular details all around you, but because you were the newcomers.
Yes, that's true. And in fact, when I think about the effect of having lived there, of course, it took me 200 pages to just make a gesture at articulating it in the book, but one of the things that did happen was I'd already been a pretty detail-oriented person, but moving to some place where that is an end in itself and is not going to be something that accrues into, I must be an artist of this or that stripe, or I'll write something about this, or, you know, people make movies about these moments, or look at me living this kind of very aware life. You get out of kind of the self-consciousness of Los Angeles, and knowing that I might well be watching my tea kettle boil in Utah slowly while I wake up, you know, for the rest of my life, just for the purpose of paying attention to detail and looking out my window at the mountains and seeing, you know, if there were any moose wandering by on the golf course that near where we lived, this and that. It, like listening better, was a very kind of Buddhist almost experience of taking things as they come. Because while I moved there to have experiences, I did not move there to write a book. So I wasn't processing things and cataloging them in that way when I moved. I was just trying to look at things with a clean slate. And I did do that. And as you point out, it's made for that. I mean, I certainly was primed to pay attention at that point in my life. But just some of the beauty and some of the experiences are just flat out unignorable. And that really helped bring me to attention, call me to attention.
Well, let's jump to a place that is near the end of the book when you're getting ready to leave Utah.
Okay. Leaving is an experiment. I can only say, and I'm amazed to say it, I've never before left a place I loved. Always finished with the people and the sights, the responsibilities and the mistakes, dissatisfied with the place or myself within it, always urged by a better idea and usually downright bored. I'd had no idea what I was feeling now, even as I was living it, calling it fascination, mistaking it for research, and not knowing it was love. I always said before I moved here that it would take something huge to make us stay, some sign that would indicate that terminal degrees were less important than this home. I'm afraid now that if that sign happened, I must have missed it, single-minded as I can be. Maybe I was looking too hard, thinking too big, not trusting the simple answer in my blood. Maybe I didn't believe in the power of forward momentum, but here we are, preparing to leave. I'm afraid I've made a horrible mistake, and I can't believe I got Christopher to agree to it. Of course, for him, being closer to family is most important, and the rolling hills and trees of the southern Midwest remind him of upstate New York, where he was raised. He never had the love I do for harsh land, land one has to work toward understanding. Just the other day, I sighed, dramatically, I'm afraid, across some gray gold fields in Idaho. I'll miss these long views. Oh, he said, there's beautiful views there. He meant without buildings, but I meant without trees. To imagine my views circumscribed by rings of trees and short slopes of gentle hills, rising so easily to one step, so spoon-fed a landscape, all curves and no lines, feels claustrophobic from here. I can only hope I'm wrong, that some love waits in the creases of hills and undergrowth of trees that I don't know yet. I'd already flown to southern Ohio in the flats of Appalachia to search for a house. The wall of humidity and the vines hanging off of highway billboards, the click of frogs from ponds in every other field felt like a foreign country to me. But this is America, I heard myself thinking, and I'm from around here, right? Still, I cried when my plane got back over the desert, when I could breathe again over spines of rock, knowing I was going to have to leave it all. And so an assessor has recently been to our home in Utah as a preparatory step to placing our house on the market. This seems infeasible while I'm living it, that a home can be sold, the dense weft and weave of this air, this solid, clenching handful of life. But the assessor stopped his car in the middle of the road, walked past Christopher and stood open-mouthed at the street's dead end, gazing rapt not at the house but at the mountain. I've driven through Wellsville dozens of times, he said, but I've never been on this street. This is a good sign, assessment-wise, as it means private. Yes, I tell him. We see as many horses go by as cars. This view, he tells us wonderingly, gravely, is extremely rare. And he turns his head to take in the busy chickens and placid cows and the scattered presence of cottonwood trees and the lack of neighbors. In assessment speak, this means worth a bunch of money. My heartbeat suddenly feels like there's something wrong with it. Remind me, why am I leaving this? Why are you selling this? He in fact asks, bewildered. I step inside the house to stare in confusion at the walls and let my husband deal with the talking. Why are we selling this? What will someone else pay for our dream, the way we paid so hopefully a few years ago, and why are we selling it? Are we sure we can get that hope back when we call for it later, anywhere but here, anytime but now? We'll find out. We'll be back. We'll be back. I hear the man say over and over as if trying to convince himself. Of course, this is an exceptional day. He means that the air is so clear and the sky so sunny, the mountain so perfectly snow-capped that the view is postcard-worthy, which must be a coincidence timed with his presence. No, I want to tell him, this isn't exceptional. The mountain looks that close and sight-filling, that mouth-watering every day. It calls and answers. That the view is worth money is insulting to me, that someone else may buy my kitchen window full of mountain and rip it down, realign a new monstrous dwelling to maximize that view, and cart away as junk the boards and plaster where I lived. My old house is a constant project, not the move-in most of the local new subdivisions are building, I know. But I'm kept in mind of a book I'd read in class the last semester, which my classmates may have seen as homework, but I'd begun to willfully read as parables, named Staying Put. Scott Russell Sanders wrote that mortar and nails alone would not have held the house together even for 60 years. It has needed the work of many hands, the wishes of many hearts, vision upon vision, through a succession of families. I would like my little family not to be the last on the record for this house. Being the last people to live inside this house would seem to represent a failure of stewardship on my part and a dismantling of my own memory. And I do want these memories. These are holding me to the earth.
Liz Stevens lives and teaches in Southern California. You'll find more about her and her book at our blog, which is located at mtpr.org/twq. Also on our blog, Monday poems, book reviews, and links to our podcast and Facebook page. Thanks for listening. Until next time, I'm Cherie Newman, wishing you a stack of fascinating books and lots of questions.
The Right Question is produced by Cherie Newman, with help from Barbara Thoreau and Kim Anderson. Michael Marsalek, executive producer. Beth Ann Austin, studio engineer. Music for this program was written and performed by John Floridis. The Right Question has a Facebook page, a blog, and a podcast. You'll find links to all that at mtpr.org/twq. Thanks for listening and for supporting this program.